are.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo, sitting in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Delaware Valley Job Corps shut down without warning and then reopened just as fast. But questions still remain. We talk with a top official to find out what's really happening behind the scenes. Also, hundreds of letters pour into the Beacon Post Office box every month, all from people in prison asking for books. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim brings us a story of the Prison Books Project and how it's grown from one local bookstore to a statewide mission. And it's the 56th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair. All this week, we're teaming up with Bethel Woods to celebrate. Today, we're talking with legendary photographer Elliot Landy, the man behind some of the most iconic images of the era. Plus, we'll talk to local economist James B. Huntington. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump is scheduled to share more information at a news conference this hour on his plan to address public safety in Washington, D.C. He says it involves, quote, ending the crime, murder, and death in the nation's capital. Violent crime is down in the city. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
In a social media post during the weekend, President Trump said he will announce his plans for the city with a focus on crime and cleanliness in the District of Columbia. In another post, he wrote, quote, "The homeless have to move out immediately." Trump added that Muriel Bowser, Washington, D.C.'s Democratic mayor, quote, "is a good person who has tried, but she has been given many chances." Statistics from D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department show violent crime has been falling after a 2023 peak. President Trump's recent anger over D.C. crime seems to have been spurred by an assault in the city of a federal employee and former DOGE staffer. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
A trial begins today over President Trump's deployment of the National Guard to Los Angeles. The president sent thousands of troops to the city for immigration enforcement in June. It sparked days of unrest and protests. Governor Gavin Newsom sued the federal government. It's a three-day non-jury trial, which means the judge will decide. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin are scheduled to meet Friday to discuss ending Russia's war in Ukraine. The full-scale war is in its fourth year. The two leaders will hold talks in Alaska. The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, says he believes progress in the week ahead is possible.
While it's been slow and it hasn't been certainly revolutionary, there have been some successes in this dialogue that President Trump has created between Russia and Ukraine, between himself and Russia, and between himself and Ukraine.
Whitaker spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Vice President Vance said over the weekend the U.S. is trying to bring Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to the table. EU foreign ministers are meeting today to discuss the war and the positions of its 27 countries. Stocks open mixed this morning as investors wait for new inflation data this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow slipped about 30 points in early trading.
The Labor Department is set to report new cost of living figures tomorrow. Forecasters say core inflation could top 3% as President Trump's tariffs begin to push the cost of imported goods higher. Headline inflation should be a bit lower, however, thanks to a drop in gasoline prices. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is in temporary command at the IRS following the ouster of IRS Commissioner Billy Long last week. Long, who's an auctioneer and former Missouri congressman, was dismissed after less than 2 months on the job. The shakeup continues a turbulent period at the tax collection agency, which has lost thousands of workers as it prepares to implement the tax changes in the big GOP budget bill. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. U.S. Women's Gymnastics has one of its youngest national champions. As NPR's Matt Bloom reports, 17-year-old Hesley Rivera came out on top in last night's finals in New Orleans.
Rivera earned her first all-around first-place title with top scores in three events, balance beam, uneven bars, and floor exercise. It marks the New Jersey team's latest high-profile win after helping the U.S. women's team earn gold in the Paris Olympics last summer. Here's Rivera speaking to NBC after coming off her winning floor routine.
So much work in the gym, hard work, blood, sweat, and tears. So I'm just so grateful that I'm here today.
Fellow Olympian Leanne Wong nabbed second. The two are early favorites to represent the U.S. at the World Championships in Indonesia this fall. and summer games in Los Angeles in 2028. Matt Bloom, NPR News, New Orleans.
A federal judge in Manhattan today rejected the Trump administration's request to release grand jury transcripts. These stemmed from the Justice Department investigation into sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's longtime confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell. The Texas State House will attempt to reconvene today. About 50 Democratic representatives left the state to block Republican efforts to redraw congressional maps that favor the GOP. President Trump is trying to pick up 5 congressional seats in Texas ahead of the midterm elections next year. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo, sitting in for Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We've been following the uncertain future of the Delaware Valley Job Corps in Sullivan County. Job Corps is a federally funded vocational program that offers housing and job training to low-income youth ages 16 to 24. Initially, a federal judge issued an injunction earlier in June blocking the Department of Labor from closing the Job Corps centers, including Delaware Valley, pending a lawsuit that argues the shutdown violated federal law. That was on June 4th. Which allowed Job Corps students to return at Delaware Valley. Approximately 100 students resumed training and housing, but the dispute didn't end there. In late July, the same federal judge scaled back the nationwide injunction to apply only to certain centers affected by the shutdown, citing a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision which limits the use of sweeping nationwide injunctions. Radio Catskill's Annie Bennett spoke with Jennifer Cha, Vice President of Programs and Regional Operations at Adams & Associates, the organization that operates the Delaware Valley Job Corps, about what's happening behind the scenes as the center waits on key decisions from both the U.S. Senate and local courts.
I'm Jennifer Cha, the Associate Vice President of Programs and Regional Operations for Adams & Associates.
Great. And what happened last month with Job Corps?
So to update where we left off, we continue to sit in a bit of a stall, if you will. We are encouraged that the Senate Appropriations Committee, including Senator Gillibrand, supports a bill that will fund Job Corps in the next fiscal year. And that was the budget that the president had recommended, the elimination of the funding. The Appropriations Committee suggested the other day that the same amount of money that Job Corps has been given before be given to Job Corps again so that the program, the school, the work can all continue. The Senate will then consider that legislation in September, so next month. And then after that will be negotiations within the House of Representatives. So while we're still kind of in a wait and see mode a little bit, we are operational with the active students that we have.
So let's break this down a little bit for people that may not be as familiar. So my understanding, President Trump, with all of his budget cuts, proposed that next year Job Corps funding be cut, but also submitted a notice of cancellation for the whole program with about 30 days notice. Is that right?
Correct. There are really a couple of things happening simultaneously, if you will. We have the president put forth in his skinny budget the elimination of the program, but that's just that skinny budget is a recommendation. Job Corps funding comes through the Appropriations Committee in Congress, and we are actually already approved through Congress for funding 2025 through June of 2026. So the budget that he had put forth the skinny budget for was 2026 to 2027.
Right. So then why the notice of immediate termination?
Well, that's a separate simultaneous issue happening in which the contractors, because 90 of the Job Corps centers nationally are run by private operators, all on contracts, those were terminated a couple months ago with this notice to send students home and to close the program. a lawsuit was generated to stop those terminations, to stop sending students home, to resume operations. And the judge in that case did issue a temporary restraining order and later an injunction to stop the termination of the contracts to allow operations to continue while the lawsuit, which takes quite a bit of time, is sorted out in the courts. So operations resumed, training resumed, students, some returned to the centers, some that left have not returned because obviously that's very destabilizing for young folks. And so, again, we're trying to restabilize the program while the lawsuit sits out in the future. We're hopeful that the Job Corps lawsuit will be resolved, that Congress will continue to fund Job Corps, that enrollments will reopen, and that Job Corps gets back on track.
What was the reason behind the contractors being terminated, if not the funding cuts?
Within all of the contracts, there's a clause for termination of convenience, which means, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to misspeak here,
okay,
but that at the convenience of the government, they can terminate the contract based on whatever criteria or whatever cause they seek.
But you have no idea what the reason was for it.
You know, the dissatisfaction with different reasons, whether those were valid or not, I couldn't get into.
Are you able to share any of the reasons that they did cite?
There were some concerns with the money management, with program outcomes, but the information was reflective of outcomes during the COVID pandemic. So the data, in my opinion, was a little skewed. But again, you know, that's potentially at their discretion.
So if it is part of the contract that they are able to do a termination of convenience,
right,
then what is the standing in court saying that this isn't allowed?
Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that it references the causing of undue harm to individuals, for one, and also wherein rests the authority to terminate the contract.
Can you give us some specific examples of some of the harm that the termination notice has caused? You mentioned some students haven't come back.
We're primarily a residential program. And so students, for the most part, not only train on centers, but they also reside there. Their housing, their food, some cursory medical supports and other supports all come from the program. In order to qualify for the program, young adults between 16 and 24 have to satisfy an income eligibility, which is below the federal poverty threshold. In many cases, young people who participate in the program do not have the average supports that somebody would have. They may be homeless, for example. They may not have the means to have that same support structure normally without the program. And so being quickly sent off center to what in many cases is unstable housing, non-existent housing, unsafe housing without any pre-warning. And at the time, the directive was within a week, is obviously extremely destabilizing. It would be destabilizing for somebody who was stable, right? Who had a history of having supports or far outreach. But in these cases, these young people obviously had come in trusting that the program would satisfy its commitment to them, provided they satisfied their commitment, which was to train, to study, to work toward the future, to follow a career path. To have the rug pulled out from them is emotionally destabilizing. But in this case, for many young adults, it was physically destabilizing because they didn't have anywhere to go. The food, the bed, I mean, the supports. The program is, there's nothing like it. These are people who have aspirations for a future of employment, of hard work, of contribution. And that is their intention when they enroll in the program. And that is what the program provides the structure for them to achieve. So if a young person lives in an unstable environment, it is very difficult for them if they need to focus on where the next meal they're going to eat is going to come from. Everybody has not returned. We have brought a lot back. We have 17,000 young people nationally who have actually applied to the program since March. But because the background checks were paused in March, which is required for enrollment into the Job Corps program, those 17,000 people have been denied the opportunity to pursue this training, pursue the career that will provide for them and their family in the future.
So that's why enrollment hasn't returned even during the temporary pause on the order.
Correct.
And you said that some of the students returned and some did not. Do you have any sort of numbers about what percentage of them were able to come back?
It's dependent on centers. In a lot of cases, it's about 30, 40% did not return of those who left. Delaware Valley, for example, everybody didn't leave because we're still trying to find housing.
Why is Job Corps important for Delaware Valley specifically?
It does provide not only a place for young people to go to receive this training, but they are engaging at any given time in 10 different trades of training: electrical, carpentry, culinary. A key component of the program isn't just that you isolate the student on a center and stick them in a room and train them, but it's that they go out into the community and practice the skills that they're learning at various stages. Centers also do very high levels of community service. And so there are all types of ways that a center like Delaware Valley not just pulls from the community to then generate young adults who are participating in the community, but while they're enrolled in the center, the community is actively involved in the Delaware Valley. Of course, we have more or less 100 local residents who are employed at the Delaware Valley Job Corps Center, full-time staff, many of whom have worked there for year upon year and really dedicated themselves to this program that is in pursuit of an improvement for the community as well as the young people within the community. So those staff also are at jeopardy here.
Even if they were stable, full-grown adults, this would still be jarring. So imagine how it is for not only youth, but especially low-income youth with unstable housing. And do you have any sort of timeline about when you'll hear back from the Senate and or from the local lawsuit that's going on?
So the congressional pieces hopefully will be worked through in September and landing in October when the budget actually goes, as I understand the timeline. So hopefully within the next 60 days, we would have some really firm grasp on that. And again, that funding is for July 1st, 2026 to June 2027. We were already approved for funding for the fiscal year that we are in right now, all the way through June 30th. So that addresses the following year. In terms of the lawsuit, I don't have an exact timeline for that. We are certainly hopeful that it can be resolved with a meeting of the minds. And let me just be clear, there is nothing more hopeful than a Job Corps student enrolling in the program. These are not individuals who are walking in asking to just take, and not put in the work. It's established in this 60-year-old federal program that's original roots were tied to President Johnson's Anti-Poverty Act. So the whole structure and intention of it is still in place and still aligned with that mission.
And just to clarify, while the lawsuit is pending, other than new enrollments and the students that weren't able to return, regular operations are going on right now, right?
Regular operations are fully functional right now. Great. Outside of the background checks. And so, you know, you can still apply for the program. Families who hear the description of the program and that strikes a chord with you, this is a life changer. And I can't tell you how many individual stories I've heard and witnessed myself at various centers of lives that have been completely changed by this program. And the way the community has really rallied around has been a boon for us and for everybody at the center.
Well, Jennifer, Radio Catskill will definitely stay in contact with you as this all sort of boils down. But great. For now, we'll keep waiting on more news. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
You bet. Thank you. I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. From Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a Hudson Valley nonprofit is helping to rewrite the narrative around incarceration, one book at a time. We'll learn more about the Prison Book Project and how local bookstores are connecting with incarcerated New Yorkers across the state. This is Radio Catskill.
NPR shows the work behind our journalism.
So I had to search through 130,000 plus contracts to see if I could match them up with what Doge shared.
So you don't have to guess at how we got the story.
I've been doing this a long time, and these conversations are among the most sensitive I've ever had.
Support rigorous independent journalism today. Make your gift to the station. And thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
I'm Jesse King. On this week's 51%, we speak with journalist Katie Simon about the road to healing after sexual assault and how that road can look different for each person.
I really just emphasize all these things are kind of individual, and be patient with yourself. Like, you can move through it. It's just, you know, it takes time.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Patricio Roballo. Local bookstores are bringing books to prisons throughout New York State. The Prison Books Project, in partnership with local bookstores throughout Ulster and Dutchess counties, is a nonprofit that was established in 2020 with the purpose of sending books to people incarcerated throughout New York State free of cost. The project has partnered with a host of local bookstores to send hundreds of books requests that come in to fill their P.O. box every month. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with the co-founder, Anne-Marie Nee, and the co-director, Michael Mart, about what inspired the Prison Books Project, the reach the nonprofit has been able to have, and what role bookstores and books more broadly play in challenging the incarceration system.
If you walk into a local bookstore in Ulster and Dutchess counties, you might encounter a shelf lined with an unusual set of books. Book requests by individuals currently incarcerated in New York that you can help sponsor and send. These shelves are an effort by the Prison Books Project, a volunteer-run nonprofit that's been working since 2020 to send books to incarcerated individuals throughout New York State at the request and for no cost. Founded in Binnacle Books in Beacon, the project has now expanded to 6 other bookstore locations spread throughout the 2 counties, including Rough Draft Bar and Books, Worlds End Comics, Blue Heron Books, Stanza Books, and Oblong Books, which has stores in both Rhinebeck and Millerton. Ironically, the initial inspiration for the Prison Books Project came out of its very premise, books. Co-founder Anne-Marie Nye, who had been working for Binnacle Books at the time of the nonprofit's establishment, as well as volunteering for the Beacon Prison Rides Project, another local organization that provides free rides for families of incarcerated individuals to Beacon's prisons, explained,
"I'm wondering if you guys could just walk me through the timeline of the Prison Books Project, you know, since its founding. Would love just to get kind of a summary of your guys' development so far."
There was an event that Binnacle had that was for a book called Prison Land by Brett Story. And part of what she discusses in the book is that prisons aren't simply a building. They're not just an edifice, but they're also a set of relationships. And so Mark Trecca, who is one of the other founders and kind of the original lead organizer of this project, and Lori Dick, who was the founder and kind of lead organizer of the Beacon Prison Rides Project at the time, had a very late night conversation where they were talking about what is the role of a bookstore in that set of relationships in the community, and what can we do to be a positive force in that sort of like web of relationships. And so it was one of those things where the idea just kind of came fully formed to them. And then we all met and figured out how to put this idea into practice. And so I've been a part of the project since that time.
This understanding of bookstores being in an active relationship with prisons became important as one of the first correctional facilities that the nonprofit started sending books to, Fishkill Correctional Facility, is not isolated but actually found within the city itself, explained Michal Mart. Mart is the current co-leader of the nonprofit and started organizing for criminal justice reform after moving to Beacon in 2011 and witnessing the scale of the prison industry in upstate New York. With the murder of a Fishkill inmate by correctional officers back in 2015, spurring her to first join Beacon Prison Action before the Prison Books Project.
So in Beacon, the Fishkill Correctional Facility is like 2 minutes from my daughter's high school. It's like a literal school-to-prison path. pipeline in Beacon. It's very close physically.
And there are over 1,700 people incarcerated in Fishkill at any given time, which if you look at the population of Beacon, makes up a significant percentage of the people who actually live in the city. And so if you shift your thinking from people who are incarcerated are going away to some place to thinking those people have been relocated into our community, that changes the relationship that we have to people who are incarcerated in our local area.
How the Prison Books Project works has not changed since it was established 5 years ago. Incarcerated individuals can send their book requests and or ask for book recommendations to the nonprofit's P.O. box in the Beacon Post Office. And then from there, the books are ordered and put on the shelves of participating bookstores, where customers can sponsor a book and write a personal note before it's shipped to a facility. All profit from book sales is donated back to the project after bookstores deduct their operating costs. But after an initially slow start to the project, what has indeed come to change is the volume of requests they've been receiving, with the nonprofit now facing a backlog in requests.
We're getting, I would say, about 120 letters a month, off the top of my head, because I have been checking the mailbox recently. You have to remember that each request might contain like several book requests, so we might be having 500 requests a month from 120 letters. Yeah, so we're really excited because we're about to reach a milestone of sending 7,000 books to almost 2,000 people. So there are, I can't say off the top of my head how many correctional facilities are in New York State, like state ones. I think maybe close to 30, 20 something. They keep closing them. And we also send to county jails and to ICE facilities and to federal prisons that are located in New York State. So yeah, we've basically touched the lives of almost 2,000 people at this point.
Rough Draft started partnering with the nonprofit in July 2023, and since they built their book display for the Prison Books Project 2 years ago, the bookstore has sent over 920 books, with about 20 to 30 book requests coming in per week, according to their bookseller Brett Jones in an interview with Radio Catskill. For Worlds and Comics down the street from Rough Draft, co-owner Christopher Levecci said they've been able to send just shy of 400 books since they joined in 2023, and the requests range from manga and fantasy novels to books about real estate investment or becoming an electrician. Having referred to the nonprofit as a mutual aid project, Nye explained that it was intentional for them to situate the project at the community level. Working among local bookstores and making community members the sponsors, Nye said, is about fostering a genuine connection between those within and outside prisons, ultimately curbing the logic of dehumanization and disappearance that underlies the prison system in the United States. On a more practical level, bookstores help fill that hole left by loved ones of incarcerated individuals facing significant restrictions in terms of what they can send inside prisons.
I was just wondering, like, what's important for you guys to work on that local level, to work, you know, within the community to send out these books versus, you know, finding a wholesaler of books elsewhere?
So one of the things that we think is actually quite unusual about this particular project, and particularly community focused, is that each person who comes into a bookstore and sees the project for the first time, that person is making a one-to-one connection with someone who is incarcerated. So that is somebody who, it is a very human connection, and it allows with a very, it doesn't require a huge commitment of the person who is sponsoring the book. But it is a significant step in terms of shifting the relationships that we were talking about earlier. So the fact that someone can walk into a local bookstore and suddenly then walk out with a relationship to someone who's incarcerated in New York State is a pretty serious transformation. And I think it's part of the reason that the project has been successful and why it has worked, in addition to fulfilling its fundamental aim, is also the way that it creates connections between people. And that wouldn't be possible if it wasn't a book that was sitting on a shelf in a local bookstore. So that is definitely part of it. Most of the way that new people find out about this project is when they stumble across the shelves in Oblong or Rough Draft or Binnacle or any of the other participating bookstores. And at various points, when the backlog has gotten significant, the project will purchase books. But we always do that as part of an event, or we get people together so that we're still writing a note for every book, getting a person who is interested in the book to write the note, ideally. So we're still looking to create connections even when we are doing things at the project level. But still, the vast majority of books are fulfilled at the level of, you know, the individual sponsors who are customers in local bookstores.
And Mart said the specific focus on sending a book, while ultimately being a minuscule act, has been able to have an impact.
I want to ask, like, why the specific focus on books and making them accessible to incarcerated individuals? I mean, what specific issues of the carceral system does, you know, the Prison Books Project and what it does, like, aims to address?
One thing is that that's really nice about sending a book, like a physical object, is that it's a gift. It's a gift, and it's a gift to that person to do with as they wish. They often like share it with friends or give it to someone else. But I've read multiple letters where they just describe that moment of being called into the mailroom and hearing that there is something coming for them, and they don't know exactly from who and from where, and just the delight and the surprise of receiving something from someone and from a group and knowing that someone cares about you. I think that's really meaningful. Not everyone, but some of the people that write to us don't have like many connections left, and maybe none even. So having a connection with our group, and often with the individual sponsor who walks into the bookstore, picks up a book, and also writes a note, it can be very meaningful. And a plus, I think almost everyone that
Mar
is involved
that
with this project just
happening within the
loves
context
books
of
and feels that,
the reverberating,
you know, each book
of the correctional
at least holds a promise to
year,
change things
significant
and
staffing
to reveal
within state
things.
Prisons and worsen conditions for incarcerated folks. The strike, which had spanned 42 prisons throughout New York State, had come after the murder of Robert Brooks by prison guards in Marcy Correctional Facility in Marcy, New York, and began in protest of staffing shortages and the passage of the HALT Act, which limits the use of solitary confinement within prisons.
One thing that is a little bit related to this, Julia, that I was important for me to mention on this call is recently there was a wildcat strike of correctional officers. And during that time, which was in February and lasted quite a long time, and it's actually not completely over yet. And it has been covered like in the New York Times, but not extensively. During that time, there were so many avenues that were for connection and activities within the prison themselves that were closed off to people. Like, they didn't go out of their cells to eat. They didn't go to recreational. They didn't have religious activities. The visitation was closed for a really long time and is still not back to normal levels. There is only one weekday visitation now, and very few facilities are back to letting people have the conjugal visits. So at this point, it feels like this connection of simply getting a book from a human outside and knowing that the outside world hasn't forgotten about you is extremely important. And this is honestly like an ongoing concern that there is not enough attention being paid to what conditions New York State incarcerated folks are experiencing. They are forgotten, like you said, Julia.
Nye said the nonprofit continues to look toward the future in terms of increasing their scale in order to be able to fulfill the hundreds of requests they've been receiving, as well as internally restructuring the project to be reflective of the very population they're aiming to serve.
So a long-term goal for this project for many years has been eventually to hand this project off to formerly incarcerated people, both in terms of running the nonprofit as a board and in terms of once the project gets to an appropriate size, having someone who is the director and an employee of the project. And I think in the long term, we would love to do that. We are not big enough to do that yet, and we don't have the structure, but that is certainly has been from the project's founding a goal for the long term. And of course, I do think that it is inevitable that as the sort of like numbers of books that we are getting, requests we are getting increase, if additional bookstores approach us and it seems like they would be a good fit to add to the project, we will do that. But It is something that has to be slow and, as Michal said earlier, at a human scale. Since we are just a small group of volunteers who are doing this, it has to happen at a pace that is sustainable.
I just spoke with Anne-Marie Nye and Michal Mar of the Prison Books Project on the work the nonprofit has been doing to make books accessible to incarcerated New Yorkers. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia, for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Local Economic Perspective with James B. Huntington. This is Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm co-star Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me. The Music Emporium. Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Ira Flatow from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Patricio Robayo. It's Monday. That means it's time for a local perspective from local economist and author James B. Huntington. James B., welcome to the program.
Good morning, Patricio. Good morning, listeners. Working 9 to 5,
what a way to make a living. So, Jim, let's take a look at what are some of the latest unemployment trends in our listening area.
Okay, we have now the June data. The most recent available came out over the last few days, shows that Sullivan County has 2.9% unemployment, up 0.1. Orange County, 3.5%, up 0.3. Ulster County, 3.2%, up 0.3. Wayne County, 4.0%, up 0.5. And Pike County, up 4.8%, up 0.5%. Now, these may seem like a down thing to happen, but the national rate during this time was at 4.4%, higher than 4 of the 5 counties, and it went up 0.4% itself. So otherwise, we are looking good in context, where Sullivan County had an especially good month. That's now 1.5% lower than the national average. So we are still doing very well in absolute as well as relative terms for a lack of unemployment in our area.
Well, that's good to know. Let's turn into some international news, something I've been listening to this morning on the BBC and NPR about the chip sales to China. If you could just tell us a little bit more on in what ways the government's cut of ship sales to China impact our area.
Yes, they are saying that 15% of the money the companies of NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices are taking in is to be handed over to the U.S. government. It's noteworthy for a few reasons. It's been put together. It's gone back and forth with our president and what we are expecting to pay in tariffs, what companies are expecting to pay and such. It's noteworthy here for a few reasons. First, it's mixing national security and taxation. Mm. The original idea was to not let China have these chips because they are considered a rather hostile power at this point, although one with whom we do a great deal of trade. So it's a strange thing that they said, well, we'll do it, but it's going to cost a certain amount of money. It's not quite the same as tariffs, but it's certainly related. And the cause for our area and elsewhere is that there may be more of these sort of deals put together, and eventually they will have to recover the money. The companies will. It's 15%. That means they would have to charge 17.6% more as a gross-up just to get something which they subtracted 15% from and to get the amount people or the amount previously they were receiving. So this kind of thing could be expensive. I hope they don't make a habit of it in Washington, because you could imagine, and eventually this sort of thing really just goes right back to the consumer.
Yeah.
It's nothing that's going to be consistently supported or absorbed by the companies involved.
No, definitely. Exactly what's been hearing in the news this morning. So, sticking with the federal government, let's talk about what happened with the Federal Reserve's favored inflation gauge.
Yes, well, this is a change for June's data. It's the personal consumption expenditures. It's the one they use the most. It rose 0.3% on a monthly basis and 2.6% for a year ago, a little bit higher than what people had expected. It's the core version of the PCE, which excludes food and energy, which tend to go up and down and fluctuate more than the others. That was also up 0.3% on a monthly basis, but 2.8% from a year ago. So this is higher. It's not stunningly high, but it's still well above the 2% that the Federal Reserve and other government offices have said they want as a continuous ongoing rate. So it's kind of mid-range. We have prices for goods in general. We're up only 0.6% in June from a year ago, so services mainly were what were higher.
Right, right. So let's bring it back down to the local area. You know, what local companies are now in the seriousing hiring phase?
Yes, there are three organizations I identified actually from my profound research going on at the Bagel Festival in Monticello yesterday. There were a lot of community organizations there, and three of them had help wanted or were hiring, and we need people for these positions out there at their booths. So I have to think they're quite serious about it, because they're putting it in front. They're sitting out there in the heat to say that they want people for these positions. They are Rolling V Transportation, which provides school buses. They're looking for people in many different roles to drive buses, AM only, PM only, class trips, afternoon sports trips, a variety of things, and they'll offer to train you. And they may be interested. They are going to hire some people, so if not you, then who? Second, we have ADAPT of the Hudson Valley, which is a provider of supports and services to people with special needs. They're looking for people with a variety of skills, a variety of positions in helping people. They offer full benefits for full-time employees. They also have part-time options available, tuition assistance, a referral bonus. So they're looking. I mean, they describe it as a rewarding career where you can make a difference, and that is ADAPT of the Hudson Valley. And then we have the New York State of Transportation, the State Department of Transportation, rather. We have highway maintenance workers in two different ranks, two different sets, trainees, people who don't have experience can get trained. The people who do can start at the full thing, the full deal. So they want people who have finished 1 year of experience with highway construction in some sort for the regular position, and they want someone to have a commercial driver's license or CDL and equipment operation certification. So if you have these things, they're looking to grab some people quite soon. So there are options out there, and these three, if you contact them, they will tell you what your chances are and meet with you if they think they're good.
Ah, it's good to know. There's James out there in the Bagel Festival working, enjoying the weather.
Yeah.
Jim, we're running out of time here, but let's quickly take a look at what's where our stock, oil, precious metal, and crypto prices are this early morning, and how did they change?
Over the last week, gold, as of early this morning, finished at $3,362, up $4. That tried to go up to $3,400, but it settled down into the same very narrow range it's been in the last several weeks. Silver, $3,780, down 49 cents. That's giving up some recent gains that have, has a ratio with gold of 89 to 1, which is still a little low. So that's anytime that ratio is low, that's a little bit bullish for silver. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 44,176, up 587. A good week overall. NASDAQ, 21,450, plus 800, an even better week, right around all-time highs. It likes what's going on with IT and artificial intelligence and similar things. On the other hand, oil, West Texas Intermediate, $63.63, down $2.90. It's the more tariffs there are, the more oil seems to go down. And we've added some tariffs, or at least conversation and possible plans about them. Bitcoin, 121,651, up 7,100, back around its all-time high after a few weeks lower. British pound, 1.3462, up almost 2 cents. Dollar is looking weaker again, and also shown by the euro, 1.1654, or down about a penny apiece. Japanese 100 yen coin stayed right where it was at its recent 68 cents. So overall, we have Trump's reaction, or the market's reaction rather, to Trump's new stuff, like this 15% plan that's going to set the tone for next week.
Definitely. Well, James, thank you so much for that. We're talking to James B. Huntington, local economics. About what's happening in our area locally. Thank you so much for talking to me. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patricio. Thank you, listeners.
All right, James, thank you for that. We'll be moving right along. It's the 56th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. Site of the 1969 festival is nearby in Bethel, New York, and kicks off a four-day festival, Woodstock Anniversary Week, tomorrow, and we partner with them to bring you the Woodstock stories this week. First up is photographer Elliot Landy. Elliot Landy is a photojournalist, author, multimedia artist, and photographer whose best-known works include portraits of Bob Dylan, The Band, Van Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and many others. Landy took many of those iconic photos of the 1969 Woodstock Festival and Arts Fair, which Landy will be back later this week for a series of events at Bethel Woods starting tomorrow afternoon. Jason Doe spoke with Elliot Landy, who will be talking about his importance of the original site, Bethel Woods, and the 1960s.
I don't have a nostalgia about the place itself, but what they've done is they've created a beautiful museum there, and it's quite a good museum. It's a very deep space, and the people there are really dedicated to the essence of what Woodstock was about, which is creating a peaceful world. All the people, except for a few, who were at the original festival were really part of the 60s peace and love zeitgeist. In the 60s, we had hopes of throwing out all the bad ways of the past and creating a new system of living together in society and so on. And I always say that people should study the 60s. It should be a necessary course in school, like what were the goals of the so-called hippies. All the things that are really smothering us today and ruining the planet got attention of the whole society for the first time during those years. The problems were known about before that, but the latter part of the 60s and the early 70s was when we had a chance to pay attention. Let's put it like that. And now we're suffering for not paying attention. It's relevant today also. And especially the Woodstock Festival was quite, I consider it like a cosmic nudge, N-U-D-G-E, to show that despite difficult times, despite difficult physical circumstances, that people can live lovingly and peacefully with each other and share and care and help each other.
This is great. As you went to the part that I was hoping that we could work our way up to, is to get somebody to talk about the bigger picture of what does this all mean and what the relevance is for today. And that's where you're starting. So I think now I'd like to just turn the clock back. How did you find yourself at Woodstock?
I was working as a photographer, but I wanted to do something to try and help stop the war in Vietnam. It was really bothering me that war was going on. So I decided then that I would take photographs of the anti-war demonstrations that were going on against the Vietnam War. They were going on. I was in New York City. I started taking pictures for a local newspaper called the West Side News, and they had a police press pass, so I was able to go to the demonstrations and stand wherever I wanted to stand. Originally, the West Side News is like a community newspaper, but then they got very political, and then also they started to crop my photographs. So I started working for another underground newspaper, which just begun, called The Rat, Subterranean News. The underground press in those years were where you got the truth from about what was happening in Vietnam. And I became the photo editor of it because I wanted to control which pictures got published and what size they were and what the layout was and so on. And they were down in the East Village on 2nd Avenue. And one evening, I was walking along after we put the paper to bed, and I see a sign on a marquee that says Country Joe and the Fish Light Show. I have no idea what that is at all. And I walk over to the box office, show them the police press pass that I had from the newspaper, and they let me go in. And I'm faced with electrified rock and roll music for the first time live that I'm hearing it, okay? With a screen the size of the complete stage behind it. And there were light projections and movie projectors, about four or five different people usually created light shows. That was the beginning of my photographing music, just by chance. And 2 weeks later, the next act was Janis Joplin with Big Brother and the Holding Company. So one thing led to another. I won't go into my whole rock and roll career story, but I got to take photographs of the band for the Music from Big Pink album, and then Bob Dylan for Nashville Skyline, and Van Morrison for Moondance. And my pictures got to be well known within the music circuit, let's say, within the music business. At that time, the band were living in Woodstock, and Dylan was living in Woodstock, and I had a little apartment in New York City, in Manhattan. And then I realized that I had more friends and it was much more comfortable for me in Woodstock. So I decided that I would get a place in Woodstock and keep my little place in the city. One day I met Michael Lang on the Village Green, and he knew about my pictures. And we would just talk every so often. We'd meet each other by chance or casually. And one day he called me up. Mike said, I'm producing a festival, a music festival. Do you want to photograph it? And I said, sure, I'd be interested in that. And he said, okay, I'll get in touch. Woodstock Festival was in Bethel. So I got there early Friday morning. I came in through the back roads over the mountains rather than through the thruway. I was living in Woodstock at the time, so I was coming from upstate. And it was just really good that I decided that I'm an adventurous person. So instead of taking the thruway in the easy way, I said, well, let me go over the back roads and see what those roads look like. So that way I really had almost nobody, no other cars, in fact. So that's how I got to Woodstock. And that's why I say I was one of the, I was an official photographer of Woodstock, because Michael and John Roberts and Joel, who I knew at the time, asked me to do it. I was identified at the time as the photographer from The Rat.
That would have been some serious cred in that scene, right?
It was, actually, because it was a very significant, very positive newspaper, actually.
You're here on Tuesday at Bethel Woods and also Wednesday, and you're doing a series of talks and presentations. You've got Elliot Landy sharing stillness energy work on Tuesday, as well as Elliot Landy photos from the scaffolding. That's an informal talk on Tuesday. You're also doing a dinner that night. That's another thing that's on the itinerary. Yeah. And on Wednesday, you've got Spirit of a Generation, which is a slideshow in the event gallery. So you're a big part of this anniversary week. What do you want to convey to people at these events when you're there?
Hope. hope, and also how to be what you want to be. In other words, if you want a peaceful life, then you have to be peaceful inside, and then the peaceful life comes to you. So the way to change your life is to change yourself inside. What sharing stillness is, that a while ago now, I discovered that if I put my hands near somebody, or I project, now I do it over Zoom also, that a certain kind of positive energy comes out and people feel really good. It's a very simple thing, but it's too complex to talk about here. I did the music photography. It was about 2 years of my life. After that period, I had a child, and then a second child 2 years later, and I spent all my time with my wife and two children, and I took pictures of them. I said, this is what I want to photograph now. This is what I want to share with people. My goal in the 60s was to bring young people, to almost to proselytize, to make people a part of this new culture, and to try and bring people like down to the Fillmore East. And also the rock and roll music at the time really expanded you. It's like a Janis Joplin talks about wanting to get the girls in the front row from the finishing schools to just let it all out, you know, just dance around and jump around and not worry about what people think of you, to free them from the restrictions of what society teaches us to be and to do and to be afraid of also.
You mentioned, you know, the Fillmore. Not too long after you stopped taking photos into music, you know, Bill Graham stops doing the Fillmores. I would always think, like, how could you end something as beautiful as the Fillmores on both coasts? And it's like, well, because that era kind of came to an end. Things changed. The business became different. So it's interesting to hear that that's not too far from where you also, you know, change paths as well.
That's interesting. Yes. That's a good observation. And the purity of the 60s started to fade away because I won't get into why, but that's what happens in life. Things change.
You know, when you look at, if anybody goes on and searches your name or goes to your website, it's elliotlandy.com, and sees like your Woodstock photos in the middle of these amazing and iconic photos, is this jarring picture of the same site a year later. And if you're talking about things nice. Fading, I mean, that's yeah. It's almost like a washed out, shorn hay field, very kind of orange and neutral tones. And it's almost like all of that vibrancy kind of faded away there.
Very interesting. I took that picture with infrared color film. So, and a magazine asked me to go up, I forget which one it was, and get on the anniversary. So I got a regular color photograph, and then I was playing around with infrared film in those years.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I've been your host, Patricio Robayo. Thanks for listening.
Fear is a normal and healthy response to things that threaten to do us harm. But fear can also hold us back from doing the things we want to do.
I look down and I'm terrified. And that was my first encounter with this fear and realizing that I'm afraid of heights.
How fear hijacks our minds, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.